Good afternoon. Thanks very much for coming today. This is the UCSD Health and Wellness Lecture Series. My name is Barry Nyman. I'm the Director of the Accommodation, Counseling, and Consulting Services. And as I hope some of you know, we provide services to staff or faculty when there's an issue associated with a medical condition and someone needs a job accommodation. And of course, we also work with their supervisors or deans or directors. We also want to make sure that the facilities and the programs are accessible at UCSD. So if you see something or know of something where someone with a disability is having some trouble getting access, please let me know, and we'll be doing our best to correct that. The Health and Wellness Lecture Series happens each month, and this month is a celebration of Abilities Month. Nationally, it's Disability Awareness Month, and within your packet, you have a yellow sheet that shows all of the upcoming events. We've got cookies, speakers, we've got videos, music, art, so I'm hoping that you find a chance to come and visit with us. As I think you know, these are recorded so that people could see them live at their desk or wherever, and then later, if you know of someone who might be interested, they can always log on to the website, which is haw.ucsd.edu, and watch it at a later point. And that's true of all the videos, so if you missed one, please check the website, and you can always view it whenever it's convenient. It's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Mark Schuchat. I've been hoping for this for quite a while, and I'm just delighted that he's able to share his time with us. He's a professor of psychiatry at UCSD, and he is also the director of the Alcohol and Drug Treatment Program at the VA here in San Diego. He's a very highly regarded expert on alcohol and drug issues, and he provides quite a bit of support and assistance to people as they're trying to work through some of those issues. He's also has additional clinical interests, including the treatment of depressive disorders, anxiety conditions, and geriatric psychiatric problems. And today, Dr. Schuchat is going to be speaking about his research findings as they relate to how heredity and genetics might influence someone's situation with alcohol or psychiatric conditions. Please welcome Dr. Schuchat.
The research results that we've accumulated over the years. But I don't know what it is you all would like to hear. So you'll help me a bit if you can just give me some of your background. Example, how many of you spend the majority of your time doing research? There are a few of us. And because of that, I won't be talking about methods today, because there are so few of us. I'll be getting to the clinical kind of punchline from the work that we're doing. The second is, how many of you work clinically in anything in psychology, psychiatry, social work, any of those things? Just a few of us. So I will indeed not be talking a lot about direct clinical issues, but will try to place the findings that I'm going to put forth into perspective. So I imagine most of you are here because you're just kind of interested in the question, is alcoholism genetically influenced? How could it possibly be genetically influenced, and why should we care? So my interest in this area came totally serendipitously. I was a medical student, was shocked that I liked doing research, never thought I would be doing it, and happenstance. The person I was doing research with, because I needed to make some money, I needed a job, that person had happened to be interested in alcoholism. And one day, basically, as I was talking about some of the research findings on our project, I asked him whether there were any data to try to help to disentangle whether alcoholism is genetically influenced or environmental. A little bit of a simplistic question, as you'll hear, that it is neither fully genetic nor environmental. But totally to my shock, it turned out, as we started to look at the literature and do some of our own work, it turned out that genes were having a major impact on the risk for heavy, repetitive drinking with associated problems. And that's what alcoholism is. In the diagnostic manuals, it's called alcohol dependence. Some people will say it's a more broad definition of alcohol abuse or dependence, but those are just jargon. It doesn't just mean somebody drinks. It means that they're drinking heavily, repetitively, and having problems in multiple life areas. So how come 85% of the people in the United States have had some experience with alcohol? And how come the rate of alcohol dependence is 15% in men and maybe 10% or so in women? It must be something that is separate from whether you drink or not. It is a characteristic that I'm interested in studying that tells me if you decide to be a drinker and consume alcohol pretty much as you feel like, ad lib, what is it about you that might indicate that you are carrying a vulnerability to heavier drinking, less control of your drinking, and alcohol problems? So this first slide really tells us something in general, and it is that here's a baby upside down in utero. It's an illustration, as any of my illustrations that are pictures were developed by my daughter. And what I'm demonstrating is everybody enters life with various levels of predispositions toward and away from problems. Genes contribute to those predispositions, but rarely fully explain them. So for most medical or psychiatric conditions, the genes are part of the picture, and they operate primarily by putting you in a position through a variety of characteristics that contribute to the risk or, in some instances, diminish your risk. Well, what I want to do today is to review how for diabetes, high blood pressure, depressive disorder, for any major medical condition that has genetic influences, how do you establish genetic influences are operating? And then how do you start looking for the genes? And then because the genes operate in the context of the environment, how do you find out how the genes and the environment work together? Well, hidden in that broad statement is the fact that there are very few disorders caused specifically and uniquely by genes. So what you've learned about dominant and recessive disorders is true, but those types of disorders like cystic fibrosis, those types of disorders are A, relatively rare. So alcoholism couldn't possibly be one of those simple dominant or recessive disorders because 10% of women and 15% of men develop the disorder. Rather, this is typical of most disorders that are genetically influenced, not just genes. The genes are not dominant nor recessive, but the genes contribute to the risk. And before I begin with the picture as it relates to alcoholism, I could pick any one of a variety of medical conditions to try to set the template for what it is our studies are doing with alcoholism. And the one I'm going to pick instead of diabetes, the adult onset diabetes, or most forms of cancer, these are genetically influenced and environmentally influenced, I'm going to talk about heart attacks called myocardial infarctions. Heart attacks are genetically influenced. How do I know that? Because if you have a lot of relatives with heart attacks, you have an increased risk for heart attacks compared to the general population. Doesn't mean you're going to have a heart attack. It just means that you are born with an increased propensity, statistically, to have a heart attack. And not only do heart attacks run in families, but even if you are separated from your biological parents early in life and raised in families that don't have heart attacks, you will also still be carrying your increased risk for heart attacks. But the genes that contribute to heart attacks probably add up to 50 or 60% of the risk. And the environment is also important. It turns out that there might not ever actually be a heart attack gene. Despite the fact that I said it's genetically influenced, there may not be a heart attack gene. So how can that be? What is likely is that the genes in some families increase your risk for high blood pressure. There are probably 30 different ways to increase your risk for high blood pressure. And that because of the high blood pressure, One consequence is a high risk for heart attacks. Yet in other families, the blood pressure that comes down generally in that family is perfectly normal. But they have various kinds of high blood fats, which will increase the probability that you'll get clogged arteries and increase the possibility that you'll develop a heart attack. The genes are for 5, 8, 12 different kinds of blood fats, and the genes themselves don't cause heart attacks. The genes increase the risk for high blood fats, a consequence of which can be heart attacks. Not always, and not for everyone. Let's take a look at some of those risk factors as well. The high blood pressure risk factor for heart attacks. The environment is important, because if you carry the risk factors for heart attacks through high blood pressure, and A, you're overweight, B, you don't exercise, C, you're facing a lot of stress in life, and D, you don't recognize you have the high blood pressure and don't get it treated. All of those environmental factors are explaining about half of the picture of whether those genes for the high blood pressure, of which there will be many different genes, how those genes for high blood pressure are impacting on your risk for heart attacks. So most medical and psychiatric conditions are indeed genetically influenced. Alcoholism, serious repetitive problems from drinking. Alcoholism is one of those disorders that's called a complex genetically influenced disorder, where the genes operate through intermediate or other characteristics that then interact with environment and give you your final risk for a disorder. So let's apply that to alcoholism. Again, serious, repetitive, heavy drinking causing problems. There's really only one basic definition of alcoholism or alcohol dependence in the world. There are two systems diagnostically that have developed these diagnostic criteria, and they overlap dramatically. So the first issue is for children of alcoholics. I abbreviate here as COAs. Children of alcoholics have about a fourfold increased risk for alcoholism. And that fourfold increased risk for alcoholism is seen in sons and daughters of alcoholics. It doesn't matter whether your biological alcoholic parent is your father or your mother, you carry an increased risk. And similar to the data I gave you very briefly regarding heart attacks, this fourfold increased risk continues to operate at the same level or more, even if you are a child of an alcoholic who is adopted out and raised in a home that has no alcoholism in it and no alcoholism in generations before the parents. That is indeed indicative that what's coming down isn't just the childhood environment or the family environment. What's coming down regarding the risk factor has to have genes operating as well. The last bit of information that convinced me and everyone I know in the field who looks at the data that convinced me that genes have to be important comes from the twin studies. Here's what happens. There are two kinds of twins, of course. There are the identical twins who share 100% of their genes, and then there are the fraternal twins who share only 50% of the genes. The fraternal twins sharing 50% of the genes, it's the same as any full siblings share. So I have two sisters. My sisters and I each, with each sister, I share 50% of our genes. Therefore, the fraternal twins are no more alike genetically than are any full siblings. If a condition is genetically influenced, then the greater your amount of sharing of genes with somebody who has the condition, the greater your risk should be. So the identical twins of alcoholics, for example, should have a significantly higher risk than the fraternal twins of alcoholics if genes are operating. And that's what every study since 1948 that started to look at this problem has shown. The risk for alcoholism in the identical twin of an alcoholic is probably about 65%, 70%. Notice it's not 100%. And it's not 100% because genes aren't causing this disorder. They're contributing to it. And the risk for alcoholism in the fraternal twin of an alcoholic is about fourfold higher than the general population, the same as you'd see in any close relatives of alcoholics. So my work as a medical student and when I began my residency in psychiatry was related in part to trying to separate out genes and Environment and the Alcoholism Risk. We published one of the first adoption-type studies in the United States related to the question of genes and alcoholism. And I went into that study convinced that there would be no genetic predisposition. And one of many times in my life, I was wrong. But it did start a career path. And that career path has been very interesting and useful for me, and I have thoroughly enjoyed my opportunity to work in this field. So, If alcoholism is genetically influenced and genes and environment, how much of the risk is genes and how much of the risk is environment? You can use either family or twin studies to estimate something called heritability, which is just jargon for the proportion of the risk explained by genes. And for alcohol dependence, it's about 60% genes and 40% environment. And maybe some people will argue and say it's 60-40 in the other direction. That's possible. But there's almost no study in the world done well that would demonstrate no genetic loading for alcoholism. But on this slide, I also give you something else. I say that there are multiple characteristics that are being inherited that affect the alcoholism risk. Just like with heart attacks, I don't think there's a heart attack gene. I'll be kind of surprised if there's an alcoholism gene. I think that it's highly probable that the genes are impacting on characteristics that are impacting on the alcoholism risk. So let me now tell you some of those characteristics that impact on the alcoholism risk using both genes and environment. And then I'm going to select one of them, the one I happen to be studying, and I'm going to show you how that characteristic was established as important for the alcoholism risk and genetically influenced, and then how we are searching for genes for that characteristic, which then indirectly are genes for alcoholism, and how we're studying for how we're searching for how the genes are relating in the environment. Well, if I sat down and thought of it, there are probably 8 or 10 different intermediate characteristics of a person that appear to be genetically influenced that are impacting on the alcoholism risk. For example, one of them is whether you're highly impulsive or not. So if you're the kind of kid from early on and then you get into adolescence and adulthood, you think something, you do it. You don't think of the consequences. You don't learn well from being punished or the consequences of prior actions. If you live in a society like ours with alcohol and drugs available, how could you not become an alcohol and drug dependent person? This happens to be at its extreme, very high levels of impulsivity, happen to be at its extreme, a risk factor for gambling, for being unable to hold jobs, for alcohol dependence, drug dependence, heavy smoking. It is a generic risk factor, impulsivity, that at its extreme form increases your risk for alcohol, drugs, and a whole bunch of other problems. I'm involved in a study that is indeed looking for genes related to extreme impulsivity, and we have thus far found 3 gene variations that have been replicated and are almost certainly related to impulsivity. And we are in a much earlier stage of starting to study the environment. But I have a more full picture for you based on my own work in San Diego, which is another characteristic, sensitivity to alcohol. By the way, brief aside, remember that first slide I showed you, a baby entering life? You want to know the things they're predisposed toward and the things that are protecting them. And I said that genes can operate in both directions. They can increase your risk and they can protect you. Regarding one of the things I won't spend much time on today, how you metabolize or break down alcohol. There are 2 major genes involved. One of them is called ADH and the other is called ALDH. And about 40% of Japanese, Chinese, and Korean individuals have a mutation in the second enzyme, ALDH. When you have that mutation, it means that when you drink alcohol, one of 2 things is going to happen to you. Either if you have the more severe form of the mutation, you are going to get so sick at a half a drink that you feel like you have to go to an emergency room. That is genetically controlled. That form is seen in 10% of Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans. And the rate of alcoholism in those people is 0. They'd be dead first. There's no way with that mutation they can develop alcoholism. But an additional 30% of Japanese, Chinese, and Korean individuals have a less severe mutation, so that when they drink, they don't feel sick, but their face turns red, and their heart beats a little bit harder, and they're a bit more sensitive to alcohol than are others. That mutation, and there actually are about three different mutations that can do that, those mutations decrease the probability you're going to drink a lot when you drink. You're generally cut off at the lower levels of alcohol and is associated with a lower alcoholism risk, but not a zero alcoholism risk. So I've told you that one of the intermediate characteristics that has genes that impact on it as well as environment and that affects the alcoholism risk, the impulsivity in its extreme form, is actually a risk factor for alcohol, drugs, smoking, gambling, etc. And then I've told you about another risk factor that is seen only in Asians, Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans, and not anyone else. And among Asian individuals, two forms of the mutations, and one is an absolute protection from alcoholism, and the other is a relative protection for alcoholism. These mutations, nothing to do with your risk for heroin dependence, nothing to do with your risk for cannabinol or marijuana dependence. It's unique to alcohol dependence. Well, you figure it would be. It's an alcohol metabolizing enzyme. It's not an enzyme metabolizing any of the other drugs of abuse. Now, by the time I started to get interested in, yes, alcoholism is genetically influenced, what is it that might be inherited to impact on the risk? By that time, if you read the literature with any level of thoughtfulness, the information by the mid-1960s on the alcohol metabolizing enzyme mutations was already there. It wasn't fully fleshed out, but it was already there. And the information on impulsivity, genes weren't known yet, but the fact that it is probably genetically influenced and having an impact on the alcohol and drug dependence risk, that was already there. So most of my patients, as I was a medical student and now becoming a resident, most of my patients who were alcohol dependent were neither very impulsive nor Asian. So I said, if most of the people I'm seeing aren't carrying, of course, the protective factor, but aren't carrying the other another major risk factor, maybe there's something else operating here. So I started to ask my alcohol-dependent or alcoholic patients, think back to the early times when you were drinking and tell me, what did alcohol do for you? The theory is, well, maybe alcohol is affecting some people differently, and maybe they're seeking out alcohol in order to be able to help them to feel better, and the alcohol has a much stronger effect on them. I was wrong again. But what they told me was the opposite of what it is I thought would happen. The story I got most often was, early in my drinking career, I could drink everybody else under the table. Some guy next to me would look sloppy, or some gal next to me would look sloppy, and they only had two beers. I've drunk the whole pitcher, and I'm the one who becomes the designated driver because I don't feel all that drunk and I don't look all that drunk. So with that in mind, basically, we got into the possibility that one of the major risk factors for alcohol dependence is going to be how intensely a person responds to alcohol for a variety of reasons related to what my colleagues might complain about if I used any other term. I called it the level of response to alcohol, but a low level of response to alcohol is pretty much the same as a low sensitivity to alcohol. And what I want to do now is say, let's jump from the question of, is alcoholism genetically influenced? Yes, it is. Are there alcoholic genes? Probably not, but the genes relate to intermediate characteristics. And talk about this low sensitivity to alcohol, which is the intermediate characteristic that I had the greatest interest in. So how come a low sensitivity to alcohol could increase your risk when you live in a heavy drinking society for drinking a lot and getting into problems? Here was the theory, and I have data to support elements of this, and I will come to that toward the end of the talk. Okay, the first part of the theory is a truth we hold to be self-evident. And that is that when you're a kid and you drink alcohol, the probability is you drink for the effect. And the effect is usually intoxication. I don't see a lot of kids who pick up a beer and say, Budweiser, probably from the Midwest, probably about 2007. Yeah, they take the beer, they get it down, they go for the intoxication. So if a kid is drinking for the intoxication, and most of us learn how to drink and how to control our drinking in the mid to late teens to early 20s. So if a kid is drinking for the intoxication, and if they need more alcohol to get the effect they want, it's also self-evident. Most kids will drink more in order to get the effect that they want. What that does, drinking more per occasion, which we've documented as young as age 12 in kids through self-reports, I'll get to that in a second, that drinking, needing more for an effect and drinking more, most times you drink, then contributes to the fact that birds of a feather, you end up picking friends who drink like you do. You don't go out drinking with me. Because after about three drinks, if I've had them too quickly, in fact, after two drinks, I'm awfully tired. And I don't want to go on to much more. I'm spoiling your fun. I don't like spending all the time drinking that you as a low sensitive or a low responder does. So you end up associating with people who drink similarly to the way that you drink. Then those peers and your experience with those peers impacts on what you seek and what you expect. You go out now expecting, I'm going to have six or eight beers tonight in order to have a good time, or I'm going to have 12 beers tonight to have a good time. And what it is you seek during that time of intoxication, your expectations of the effects of alcohol also get impacted. This is all, depending on how you define things, this is all environment. So the peers you choose, your attitudes towards alcohol, which I'll say roughly is environment, the level of stresses you're under and how you handle those stresses are just three examples of how having a low response to alcohol, needing more for an effect, drinking more heavily each time you drink, will then set on a cascade that won't always occur, but will contribute to how this low sensitivity to alcohol contributes to the alcoholism risk. I will skip over a few slides here and there. It'll depend upon areas that probably you'll be more interested in or less interested in. So let's now take a look at the low sensitivity to alcohol. This is another slide my daughter did for me. And I have a book called Educating Yourself About Alcohol and Drugs. And it is basically for people to learn about what alcohol and drugs are doing to them and what they're at risk for and what happens if they develop problems and they need treatment. And this is a chapter that basically, I suppose, could be called You Are What You Drink. So it is saying that alcohol and other drugs go to the brain, change how, here's a pill head, a pill bottle is their head, as a person's head. They really change how you feel. They impact on your brain chemistry. And one of the factors that is impacting, at least on your alcoholism risk, and it is how sensitive you are per drink. So, first question when I started to do this work is, okay, I can get stuff from the literature and can do some research myself. Is the sensitivity to alcohol or a low level of response seen in populations that are at high risk for alcoholism? It took us about 10 years to do the work with sons and daughters of alcoholics. This was done at UCSD. 20-year-old drinking but not alcohol dependent individuals. We took half of our 453 people that we studied in one set of studies. We took half of them because they had an alcohol dependent father or mother. And it was almost always the father as we selected them. And we took half of them to be controls who have no family history of alcoholism, but at the time we tested them, had pretty much the same drinking history. They'd been drinking for the same number of years as the family history positive people. They had the same usual drinks per occasion, etc. And it turned out clearly that the children of alcoholics showed less sensitivity to alcohol. Basically, we would give them the alcohol to a given blood alcohol level. Both groups are at the same blood alcohol level. And we test things like coordination and changes in blood hormones and changes in brain waves, various things about how the alcohol is affecting them. Two groups, identical blood alcohol levels, but about 40% of the sons and daughters of alcoholics and only about 10% of the children of non-alcoholics showed that they were in the lower portion of the level of response to alcohol. Well, it wasn't my work, but somebody else did the same kind of work in Native Americans. Not all Native American tribes have a high risk for alcoholism, but most do. And in one of the Native American tribes with a high risk for alcoholism, the Native Americans showed a lower response to alcohol, lower sensitivity. They needed more alcohol for effect than was true in the comparison groups. And then among Asian individuals who don't flush, 60% of Japanese, Chinese, and Korean don't flush. They don't turn the red or get sick when they drink. And among non-flushers who don't carry that genetic mutation in the alcohol metabolizing enzymes, there's only one group with a high risk for alcoholism. It ain't the Japanese and it ain't the Chinese, it's the Koreans. So both in Korea and in Korean Americans, the Koreans have a higher risk for alcoholism than other Asian groups. And in some work done here in San Diego by Tammy Wall, the Korean Americans showed a lower response to alcohol, similar to what the children of alcoholics would show. But Jews, who have overall low alcoholism risk, and if this paradigm is working, should be more sensitive to alcohol. Well, some say we're sensitive to everything. But indeed, we are more sensitive to alcohol. African Americans actually have a lower risk for alcoholism and drug dependence than the general population. And very few data so far, but the few data that are there look as if the African Americans that we have tested are showing a lower response to alcohol. So the first stage of the work. I could have told you that in animal studies, it was fairly obvious that in a strain of rats or a strain of mice, that you can breed strains of mice or rats to be more or less sensitive to alcohol. So we knew there was probably a genetic component to it. The first stage of our work was to say, okay, is there any relationship between a person's overall background risk for alcoholism and their sensitivity to alcohol? And indeed, there is. Next question we wanted to ask is, if we could figure out a way to measure somebody's sensitivity to alcohol real early in life, maybe within the first five times or so that they consumed alcohol, that would be age 12 to 14 in all likelihood. If we could find a way to do that, there should be a correlation real early on, before they could possibly develop tolerance, adapt to the drinking, real early on there should be a relationship between their sensitivity to alcohol and how much they drink per occasion. So before I show you those data, let me give you some background. I was real lucky. About 5 years ago, I happened upon a study being done in Bristol, England, where they identified about 8,000 kids born in the Avon Valley, that's right near Bristol, England, in a particular year. And they've been following these kids every year. And when these kids were hitting age 12, they were looking for somebody to collaborate with them who knew something about alcoholism. Prior to that, they'd been studying environmental pollutants and violence in the home, very important things, but had not been studying anything related to alcohol or drugs. So we put together a questionnaire, which we've since demonstrated works fairly well. And that questionnaire would ask someone who has experience with alcohol how many drinks it took for various effects. And among those effects could be, how many drinks did it take before you knew you weren't drinking water? If I were to answer that, a half a beer, a half a standard drink. And how many drinks did it take until you felt as if you were slurring your speech? For me, if I drink two glasses of wine fairly quickly, or if I have two beers within too short a period of time, I start slurring my speech. And till you stumble or till you fall asleep when you didn't want to, you can then take a look at how many events they had very early in their drinking career, count up the number of drinks that they reported for each of the effects that they had, divide it by the number of effects, in other words, get the average. And that can also be used as a measure of sensitivity to alcohol. It correlates pretty well with the other thing that I could do only with people old enough to give informed consent, not a 12-year-old, was to give the alcohol to a certain level and then compare group A and group B. Here, I want to get kids really young who have started their drinking, and I want to find out about their sensitivity. And indeed, the correlation between their sensitivity to alcohol and how much they drink per occasion was close to 0.5. To put into perspective, 1.0 is perfect. Most things that I'd look at as correlations would be about 0.2 to 0.3, depending on what you're looking at. But 0.5 is very strong correlation. And, of course, their sensitivity to alcohol also correlated with alcohol problems, didn't do as well with frequency, but why should sensitivity to alcohol correlate with how often you drink? It really correlates with when you decide to drink, how much are you likely to drink, and what kinds of problems are you likely to develop. So this sensitivity to alcohol, genetically influenced in animals, probably in people, this genetically influenced characteristic is seen in groups at higher overall risk for alcoholism, and this genetically influenced characteristic is also observed very early in life, within the first few times a person drinks, and correlates pretty highly with, even at that very young age, their risk for problems and how much they're likely to drink per occasion. What's important here is there are a bunch of different ways we've looked to see about genetics of sensitivity in humans. And remember that heritability thing I told you, which is the proportion of the risk for whatever characteristic that's explained by genes? It's about 60% for the level of response to alcohol. There's a group of people in Australia who took identical twins and fraternal twins in their early 20s, similar to the kinds of people we tested, and looked at the level of similarity on sensitivity to alcohol in identical twins versus fraternal twins. It was much closer, the correlation's much higher in identical versus fraternal twins. From that, you can compute the heritability, abbreviated as H squared, which is about 60% of the risk is indeed, for a level of response to alcohol, is genetically influenced. And probably most importantly, is there any evidence that this genetically influenced characteristic, sensitivity to alcohol, that's seen in groups at high risk for alcoholism, seen early in life and correlates with how much you drink, what do we care unless it predicts later heavy drinking, later alcohol problems, and later alcoholism? Basically, I'm only showing you here four studies, one done in Denmark, one in Australia, our study in San Diego, where we have a 95% 25-year follow-up rate for the people that we've been studying. And there's a group in Colorado. But there are other studies done both in the United States and the United Kingdom. Every study I know of that's looked at sensitivity to alcohol earlier in life, measured either by giving alcohol and seeing how sensitive they are, or by this self-report measure of how many drinks for effect, every study shows that the low response to alcohol earlier in life predicts alcoholism later in life. Okay, where are we going to take this, and why should we care about any of this information? So this is easy to fix. And I am going to now get us to here. And, okay. And I will somehow get this to be large. Do you know how to get this to be large? Where is resume slideshow? Right there. Thank you. Lovely. Okay. So, about 10 years ago, remember we started this work when I was in medical school, expanded the work when I was in residency. I got real lucky to be working in an area that turned out to look like it's bearing fruit. That about 10 years ago, it became apparent enough that this was pretty valid risk factor for alcoholism. And if it's genetically influenced, there are two things I want to do. One, I want to find the genes that are contributing to the characteristic. Two, I want to find out the environment that's affecting how that characteristic relates to alcohol outcomes. And three, I'd love to start to put together prevention programs for people carrying a high risk for alcoholism through this mechanism as early in life as I can. Well, I'm currently addressing the first two of those issues and hoping sometime within the next few years to turn to the third of the issues. So the next question is, how can you take a characteristic that's genetically influenced, but it's complicated, it's not caused by genes, and how can you start looking for genes that contribute to that characteristic? The simplest way is something called an association study. And what an association study does is say, okay, let me identify a group that has the characteristic I'm interested in, and a group that clearly does not have the characteristic I'm interested in. Then let me guess which of the gene variations they could have might have contributed to the low response to alcohol, and then evaluate the two groups. If I'm right, Then the group with the low response will show the gene variation or mutation I'm interested in, and the other group won't have it very much. Where am I going to get the guess? The guess as to which genes I want to look at is going to come from animal studies. Remember, alcohol sensitivity, strongly influenced by genes in animals. Much easier to do genetic studies in animals. So we look through the literature to try to find genes that have variations that in animals are almost certainly contributing to the sensitivity to alcohol. And there were two such variations that I was very interested in. And the specific variation doesn't matter very much. It turns out that variation one is a gene related to how much of the brain chemical serotonin you will have remaining between two neurons. So this thing is really attacking me, isn't it? So we took a look at these two genes. We're going to restart later. Good. We took a look at these two genes, one a variation of controlling serotonin in the brain, and the other a variation that controls another brain chemical called GABA, G-A-B-A, which actually is one of the mechanisms through which alcohol operates, affecting GABA. There was an animal study that said if there was this variation, a particular variation, in one of the GABA receptors, that the animal showed a low response to alcohol. And then there were other tests in both monkeys and in rats that said if there was a particular variation of this gene, that the animal took, basically had less response to alcohol. And by the way, the animal drank more per occasion in a free choice situation where they could choose water or alcohol. So what we did is we didn't have any money for this. So we kind of bootlegged as best we could. We took 100 of the guys that we were following up. Remember, I told you we had 453 guys who we've been following up now over years, and we have 95% 25-year follow-up rate. Well, at their 15-year follow-up, which would have made them about age 35, I had their level of response to alcohol when they were 20. I know from my follow-ups whether they became alcoholic. And for 100 of them, because we didn't have a lot of money, 100 of them, we gathered bloods and looked at these two gene variations. And what we found was, I don't know what I'm doing wrong here, let me try this. Sorry. I'm going to come down here, and I'm going to do this and see if that works. There we go. Okay. So here's gene variation one. And there are, for our purposes, from gene variation one, there's a form of that gene variation I'll just abbreviate as LL. We thought that the people with LL would show a lower response to alcohol relative to the people who had the predominant other form of that gene. And these are all basically relative to each other forms. And this group is indeed much lower on their response to alcohol overall than the other form. And 57% of these 100 guys were alcoholic, compared to 12% who had the other form. Now, the second gene, the GABA gene, the specific variation we were looking for was also associated with a low response to alcohol, and 70% of them were alcoholic. And there were 6 guys who had both gene variations. They carried both the variation in the serotonin gene, one of many, many serotonin genes, and the variation in the GABA gene that we were interested in. And at least they were all alcoholic. At this, it'll never turn out to be 100. We have only 100 guys, and that it just turned out that the 6 guys with the combination were all alcoholic. Now, 70% alcoholic, 85% alcoholic, I can understand that, but the environment is important as well. And so it's just probably from a small sample. But the issue here was, if you have a gene variation, and here are all the gene variations that we're looking at right now. They're just a bunch of different gene variations. If you have a gene variation that the animal work tells you might be related to the sensitivity to alcohol, you can test it in people. You just find out a group with a low response, group with a high response, and especially if you've got a prospective study, those who developed alcoholism and those who didn't, and see whether the gene variations apply. A word of warning. These association studies should never be believed until they're replicated. There are so many things that can make your data look squirrely and look much better than it actually is. But these are very good leads, and I'm almost sure the serotonin variation will be important in the level of response to alcohol. And we have about four others that are looking like, in most studies, not all, they're being replicated. But to finish off our work today, having told you that alcoholism is genetically influenced and it's genes and environment, once you recognize that the genes don't cause the condition, they operate through the environment and through intermediate characteristics, the work is incomplete unless you also start studying the environment. Well, the first person that I ever worked with when I was doing research turned out, just by luck, was a sociologist. And I've been as interested in psychosocial variables as I have in biological variables as it relates to alcoholism. So this long-term study we're doing of 453 guys, and then when they marry, their spouses enter the study, and when they have children, their children enter the study, is a unique opportunity not only for us over time to look for genes, but to also begin to study some aspects of the environment. In these families where we're searching for genes, and we started with people relatively young, looked at their sensitivity to alcohol and followed them up over time, we did a literature review to try and find out those kind of environmental, in quotation, things in people's lives that seem to contribute to their alcoholism risk. And we picked roughly about 20 of them. And we have been measuring them each 5 years as we follow these guys up. And then when their kids hit age 12, we start following up exactly the same characteristics in the kids. But I'm not going to give you the whole story of this longitudinal follow-up. I'm going to give you an example of the kinds of things we can do and have done to try to look at how the characteristic that's genetically influenced, low sensitivity, is interacting with the environment to contribute to heavier drinking. And the specific example I'm going to give you is going to use, in children, alcohol expectancy. So let's talk about it a sec. It's the attitudes towards alcohol. It's what you think is going to happen to you when you drink. And there are a bunch of standardized scales that you can use to measure a person's expectancy or expectations of the effects of alcohol. And we can now put them into a computer model. Here's what happens. We say to the computer, I'm now giving you, these data are probably from about 300 kids, I'm now giving you data on 300 kids. I'm going to give you their family history of alcoholism. I'm going to give you their sensitivity to alcohol, because it's kids, it's all by the self-report measure. I'm going to give you their sensitivity to alcohol. And in fact, in all of my models, we give things like drinking in the home. We look at expectancies, peer drinking, levels of stress, how they handle stress. I'm not going to show you the complete model, but we test all of them at the same time. And what we ask the computer to do for us in something called a structural equation model, we ask the computer to tell us whether our guess about how all these things fit together is operating. Now, in the data I'm going to show you, there's going to be how things are connected, and there are going to be numbers over the lines. Pay no attention to the numbers. The numbers are similar to correlations, but they're only correlations in the context of everything else, how everything connects to everything else. Any of the lines I show you in here are statistically significant. And everything I'm going to show you here has been replicated. Doesn't mean it's perfect, but it's been replicated in other populations. So in these kids, we gave the computer the family history of alcoholism, and we were pleased to see that, as we usually find, the family history of alcoholism was related to the kid's sensitivity to alcohol. The more alcoholic relatives, the lower their risk. The family history of alcoholism was also related to how much drinking there was going on in the home of upbringing. Well, as it should be. It would be surprising if it wasn't. This little number here just means the proportion of the entire picture explained by that one characteristic. It's the proportion of the variance, and it's not important to us now. As we hypothesized, however, the level of response to alcohol was indeed closely related to alcohol expectancies, but wasn't affected very much by drinking in the home. That was a concern we had. Is observing drinking in the home as likely to impact on attitudes towards alcohol and expectations as is the level of response? No, in the models, when you look at everything together, it's the level of response. And then while the level of response or sensitivity to alcohol directly predicts heavier drinking and problems, about half of what you get operates through expectancy. Well, there was a relationship here, but it disappears when you control for some of the other characteristics. But about half of the level of response to alcohol operated through alcohol expectancy. There's a hint there. Perhaps one of the ways of decreasing the risk for alcoholism in kids who have a low response to alcohol is to work with them on what is it that they should pay attention to, expect, and learn to use alcohol for, and what are the dangerous things for them to expect and use alcohol for, as a potential prevention approach for people carrying higher risk for alcoholism. So, same data turn out to occur with peer drinking. But the impact of how level of response operates through heavier drinking peers in producing alcohol outcomes, that's only seen in the early teen years. By the time people hit their late teens to mid-20s, peers, they're important, they're related to alcohol outcomes, but they're not a way through which level of response is having an impact. So we might conclude from that, if we can replicate as we have in other studies, we might conclude for that, that teaching kids about the importance, especially kids with low response to alcohol, teaching kids about the importance of avoiding very heavy drinking peers, if it's going to be effective in decreasing the alcoholism risk, probably you're going to have to be doing that in the early teens. We won't know any of those till we go to the third step, the prevention trials, but we're at least starting to get there, to the prevention trials. So let me summarize what it is I talked about today, and then we'll take about 10 minutes for questions at the end. First of all, alcoholism is genetically influenced. Secondly, it's about half genes and half environment. Third, the genes are operating and the characteristics are operating through yet intermediate characteristics like low sensitivity to alcohol. Some of those characteristics, low sensitivity, only increases the risk for alcoholism. It does not increase the risk for any other major dependence problem or any psychiatric problems. Impulsivity, another intermediate characteristic, increases the risk for all of that stuff. And alcohol metabolizing enzymes, unique protective effects just for alcohol. So it's a really complicated picture. Looking for genes overall for alcoholism is too complicated. It's too hard because the genes probably aren't there for alcoholism. They're probably there for intermediate characteristics. But taking the step back and say, I'm going to look for the genes that contribute to impulsivity, you got a better shot. Or, I'm going to look for the genes specifically relating to low sensitivity to alcohol. You have a better shot. And for both of those characteristics, specific genes have been identified. Then, in order to take this material on to potential how do you prevent, it's an issue of how do the genes and the characteristic interact with the environment, because it's really dangerous to change somebody's genetic structure. And for something where genes are contributing to only part of the risk, I just can't see it happening. Maybe it will, but I can't see gene therapy for these complex genetically influenced disorders. The key is understand more about the environment, and from the environment, then try to put together prevention programs. So I've been really lucky. I grew up in Milwaukee. How many of you have been in Milwaukee? Well, I'm really happy to be here in San Diego. And so we were really lucky because we moved here. My wife and I moved here when we were in our residency, and this is an incredible university. Very supportive of teaching medical students. I'm in the medical school. Extremely supportive of research. And it's a place that's home to me and has been home to me for years. And all the work that I've produced here, almost all of the work that I presented here has been produced here. Some was when I was in a medical student before that, but it's just been a remarkably generative environment. So when I had the opportunity of coming and bringing some of our work to people in basically the UCSD family, I really jumped at it. Thank you, Barry, for asking me. Questions that you guys might have? Guys is generic men and women. Yes. Okay, the question is about the study in Bristol, England. Yes, I'm still involved with it. And what is going on? Regarding the study in Bristol, England, we found this relationship, as we should have very early in life, between how much a kid drinks and his or her sensitivity to alcohol. Then B, we followed a subsample of people. We didn't get everybody. A subsample of people up 2 years later and found that the low sensitivity at time one predicted heavier drinking and alcohol problems at time two, even if you controlled for what were their problems and their drinking at time one. In other words, there's a causative relationship there in all likelihood. Then three, I haven't shown you the data, but we have a paper that's just about to be published, which is one of these models, peers, expectations, level of response to alcohol, alcohol outcomes. We have a model in some 600 kids from that study. Didn't have all the variables we wanted, but we had most of them, and we've been able to replicate our work through that. And then lastly, we're working with the people at LSPAC in something, in a genetic study. And now they have a much, now we need their entire sample. We don't need subgroups. We need their entire sample in order to be able to have the ability to work with them to try and find genes related to the low sensitivity to alcohol. It's been a marvelous collaboration, and it's continuing. It's been very important to me. There was another question.
You mentioned impulsivity.
Yes. The question is, I've named several characteristics genetically influenced that are important in the alcoholism risk. By the way, they turn out not to be related to each other. They turn out to be independent. And that is impulsivity. It's got to be to a pretty extreme degree, but impulsivity. And the other was the low sensitivity to alcohol. And the question relates to, does this knowledge about them have any impact on how we treat people? I'll give you a parallel first and then the answer. The parallel is there are probably making up 100 different gene variations that impact on breast cancer. Knowing those gene variations will tell you the people at high risk. It'll probably tell you the probability it'll be a more aggressive or less aggressive form. But once you got the breast cancer, you just treat it. And the original cause doesn't have much to do with the exact treatment you do. And that's true in the alcohol dependence and high blood pressure and a variety of other different characteristic fields, which is once the syndrome is there, then often the original cause, which was years ago, or even if it's, and they're often just contributory causes rather than absolute causes, probably don't have a major impact on treatment. What we do is we take advantage of the genetics work to try and teach our patients that their kids are at high risk. Then we take a look at the fact that most of them are not very impulsive, most of our patients. But of those who, especially those who are not highly impulsive, if they give us a history that looks like a low sensitivity to alcohol, we're advising them to tell their kids not to be drinkers. Who's going to listen? What kid's going to listen? But when the kid doesn't listen and becomes a drinker, you can say to the kid, you know, the fact that you can pack a lot away is like I was when I was younger, and it really means you're at pretty high risk. So they can use that information in their families. We hopefully can use it as part of our prevention programs once we get to them. But the treatment doesn't have a major impact, does not. Yes? Hi. Yes. Yes. The question. Yes. The question is about treatment of alcoholism and the recovery rate. Let me give you a little bit of background that for long-term chronic relapsing disorders, so the disorders that tend to be long-term, require changes in your life, and those changes then have to be maintained, such as high blood pressure, adult onset diabetes, most forms of allergies, alcohol dependence, etc. The outcome is, it's not necessarily the best way to look at outcome to say 100% all the blood sugars were in the normal range. Every time I tested this guy, the blood pressure was in the normal range. But I'm going to give you data that basically say 1 year abstinence rate. And only 1 year because it took me 5 years to do a study to evaluate treatment program A versus treatment program B for 1 year outcome. You got to get your sample, you got to treat them, you got to follow them up. That's a lot of taxpayer money. And very few studies do 5 year outcomes. But not my own work, but if you take a look at people who are doing treatment of alcohol and drug dependent patients, and the people who come in are self-pay or they have insurance. Somebody's got the bucks in order to pay, and they've often got jobs and often got families. If somebody enters the program, outpatient or inpatient, stays with the program for whatever it is, 2-4 weeks, the probability among the higher functioning people is about 70% one-year abstinence rate. I love my work. People do really very well. I mean, it's not that I'm doing anything special. The VA hospital, jumping to the next level, the VA hospital is treating primarily indigent people. A lot of them don't have families. A lot of them have lost everything and are living on the street. Yet we have a 52% one-year abstinence rate from our inpatient program. They only become inpatients if they've failed an outpatient in our program. On the other hand, if you take a group of people who have this high level of impulsivity, like, and in its extreme form, people who commit multiple felonies. So you take a group just coming out of prison, and they enter treatment, their one-year abstinence rate is maybe closer to 25%. When you hear that alcoholics don't do well, usually it's in a setting of very poor people without a lot of resources going for them at this point in their life. That doesn't mean they always have to be there, but at this point in their life, often with a fairly high proportion of people with multiple impulsivity problems. Most of the studies, I think, at least as I read the literature, would be in kind of the range of the three types of outcomes I've talked about. And by the way, I haven't done 5-year outcome studies, but supposedly, if you're clean and sober at 1 year, the probability is about 70% plus of those clean and sober at 1 year will be clean and sober at 5. So for a chronic relapsing disorder, where you can't ask for total control all the time, you can ask for it and you can shoot for it, but you don't always get it, not bad outcome. Not bad at all. Yes? Okay. The question is about depression and anxiety in the lives of alcoholics. There are two ways that depression and anxiety contribute to the lives of alcoholics or drug-dependent people. The first is substance-induced. Let me take any of you, put you on a research ward, and give you lots of alcohol. And then after a few days, start measuring your mood. You're pretty depressed. The higher the blood alcohol level gets, the longer it stays there, the more depressed you get. And if I then stop, people have done these studies, and if I then stop the alcohol and follow you over the next month, you don't feel perfectly normal the day after you stop. It's somewhere of a couple of weeks to maybe as long as a month before you're kind of back to normal. And when you do stop drinking, anxiety takes over. Take somebody with no pre-existing anxiety disorder and put them on this kind of research regimen, which isn't done anymore, but was tested years and years ago. And when they come off the alcohol, very high levels of panic attacks, general feelings of anxiety, a variety of anxiety problems, that get better and better after about a month, not really totally gone, but a lot better. So that's one way. A second way that there's a relationship between alcohol, drug dependence on the one hand, and psychiatric disorders on the other, is there are a few psychiatric disorders where you clearly carry a high risk for future alcohol and drug dependence. There are very few of them. Clearly established for manic depressive disease. Very high risk for future alcohol and drug dependence. Whether that's a genetic link or it's that you get into alcohol and drugs when you're manic, who knows, but there is a link. Second is if you are schizophrenic. There's two rare disorders. 1% of the population has schizophrenia. 1% of the population has manic depressive disease. But if you have schizophrenia, you have an increased risk for alcohol and drug dependence. The third one, I already told you, but called it something else. It's the antisocial personality disorder. Severe impulsivity with repetitive chronic criminal problems carries with it a very high future risk for alcohol and drug dependence. Major depressions without manias. So patient who has a depression, let's say when they're 19 years old, they're not heavy into alcohol, it lasts for months, significantly interferes with their functioning, probably not much, if any, increased risk for alcohol and drug dependence. That's hard to tease out in the work, but most of our work done in a variety of different studies says really not very much increased risk. And the anxiety disorders, a little increased risk for alcohol and drug dependence, but not much. Are we out of time?
No, okay, good. I had one quick question.
Sure.
Do you see people who ask you about doing genetic testing as a predictor and then
right.
hoping that this could influence their
The question is about the potential role of genetic testing as a risk factor for alcohol dependence. I will tell you in general, yes, people ask for it, and I very much dissuade them for the following reason. If I know you have a family history of alcoholism, I know you have a fourfold increased risk. And by that family history of alcoholism, I've been able to tap on all the different genetic predispositions and the environment. The final picture is you have a family history or you don't. For any one of the genes, as they relate to a characteristic, it explains less of the picture than just knowing your family history. The specific genes are important, for example, hopefully when I get to some prevention trials in a few years, I'm hoping that it'll be at a point where there are enough gene variations already identified contributing to the low response that I can actually have a subgroup of people where I'm doing prevention before the first drink, saying, I don't know if you're going to become alcoholic or not, but I do know that kid has one of the gene variations that if he or she starts to drink is probably going to be associated with a low response. For a disorder like alcoholism that can ruin your life, I don't know that it's worth it. But if you do decide to drink, then these are the kinds of things I hope I'll be able to say you need to pay attention to, expectations, peers, etc. But genetic testing for these complex disorders doesn't do much good. Using as a parallel example, genetic testing for breast cancer overall, probably not a great idea, but if you have one of those variations called the BRCA gene that is responsible for a tiny proportion of the people who have breast cancer, thank goodness, because it tends to be a difficult breast cancer, that if your family's carrying the BRCA gene, which is related to a variety of cancers, that's worth testing for, because the risk for breast cancer when you carry that gene may be as high as 70%. But for most characteristics, breast cancer, prostate cancer, alcohol dependence, diabetes, most of the genes are a tiny amount of the risk. So thank you. Yes, that'll be the final question. I'm glad I got you. Good.
I just was curious. You talked about a fourfold or one parent. I just wondered if there's any data about if both parents.
Yes. Thank you. So the question is, if there's about a fourfold increased risk for sons and daughters of alcoholics compared to the general population, that is a risk for alcoholism, what if both parents are alcoholic? Goes up a little. What if both parents and all four grandparents are alcoholic? Maybe you get as high as an identical twin risk. Maybe it's going to push 70% or higher. I don't know of anything that gets you up to 100% because, again, the environment's so important. Okay? Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for being here. Good. Pleasure. Good.